Hello, I'm Anna Garde, Principal Consultant at Prospectus Executive Search Practice. We work in partnership with social purpose organisations to find talented and values-driven leaders and board members to deliver their missions. Welcome to our Leadership Impact series. This is the podcast where we explore the impact leaders are making through their work in the sector.
Today we're speaking to Pat Armstrong, the Chief Executive of Acosvo. Established in 2000, Acosvo is a membership organisation for voluntary sector leaders and senior staff in Scotland with a membership of over 500 leaders. Pat is a board member of OSCA, the Office of the Scottish Charity Regulator, and a board member of EUCLID, the European Network for Social Enterprises and Impact-Driven Leaders. Pat is also in her first year of a doctorate looking at resilience in third sector leadership. The working title of her DBA is Burnt Out or Fired Up, an exploration of what impacts resilience in third sector leadership in Scotland. Pat, it's lovely to see you this morning.
Yeah, great to see you as well, Anna, in a slightly different way to our normal coffee.
I know, this is still good in the relaxing settings of being at home. We're getting used to it slowly but surely.
Definitely, yeah.
Really good to be speaking to you today, and I know that a lot of people will be really interested to hear how you've been finding the last 6 months and more. And if you're happy to, for us too, we'll get started with some questions for you.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah, lovely. So you've developed a fantastic career from balancing life as a single mum with working and studying for your MBA to being a hugely respected third sector leader and recognised with an OBE for your services to voluntary organisations. Can you tell us more about that journey and what key lessons you've learned along the way?
Sure. And that feels like it has been quite a journey.
I bet it does.
To this point. Possibly with big birthdays coming up, it always feels a little bit like that. But I suppose from the early days, as you mentioned, there is something. I think, you know, I grew up in what would now be called an area of deprivation, but in those days I was perfectly happy and thought, you know, everyone changed their winter shoes into sandals in the summer by cutting the toes out, and you know, I was relatively happy in that. But there was something growing up that when I got to be an adult and when I had kids, I wanted something different for my kids. So I think there was probably a motivation there about, you know, moving forward, having some sort of success, however you call that, but, you know, wanting my kids to have a sort of more opportunities in life, if you like. And if you want a quick whistle stop tour of my journey,
I think that would be really good.
I left school as soon as I could, because the family thing was to go out and get a job as soon as you were old enough. So I left after what was then O-levels. I went to work in a bank and was there for 6 years. So finance and banking was the early days. And this will make me feel very old, but in those days, women didn't really do banking exams progress. They tended to leave when they got married. And I think I was a little bit pushy in that, but it just wasn't to be. But it did make me realise there was something about adapting to fit. You know, I very quickly had to learn the way you had to speak, the way you had to interact. So it was a really good learning experience. I then went on to work for about another 6 years in finance in an avionics company, which is a big employer in Edinburgh at the time. And during that time, I was married. I got married at 19. I had two kids, and very quickly found that it wasn't particularly a family-friendly way of working. And when my mum took ill, she was my main childminder, I stepped out of that because there didn't seem to be any other options, and I became a childminder, where I had been the career woman that didn't even full-time look after her own children, suddenly started looking after other people's. So that was one of the hardest jobs I ever did, actually. Quite fascinating but challenging, you know, with lots of little ones around. And I tried to do other bits and pieces. I did some research work, and also actually did knitted Shetland jumpers at the same time to bring in extra income. So being flexible and versatile was probably learned around that time. But that was also when I found out there was a third sector or voluntary sector, or, you know, I found out what was going on in my community because I was at home with kids. And I found some of the groups really helpful when you had places to go with kids and other mums in the same situation. And through that, I ended up going to work in a health project. They seemed to think because I'd worked in banking that, you know, I would have admin skills and be able to do that. And the beauty of it was I had a creche, so I could juggle okay. those things too. And so that was my introduction. I had a 6-month role setting up a health library within a local project. And then I went on to work again just for a few months for a women's project in the area, which one had led to the other. And I ended up being there for 10 years. So that was almost my apprenticeship into the sector. And I, at some point along that way, I'd went back to college and I think I'd done an HND there in business and admin. But I then started to think I was working with lots of professionals. And I was also seeing very good projects and very good practitioners getting large budgets and not necessarily having the leadership and management skills to be able to do a good job. There were very, very good practitioners at the front line, but it was the leadership and management skills that weren't always there. So I got a bit more interested in that. And the project was very good in terms of they were around supporting local women into education, training and employment. And this was back in the area where I'd grown up. So they also supported me to go back and do my MBA. So I did that while I was working full time while the kids were young. So I think the bit I learned then was sort of the multitasking piece and then being able to sort of shut out and focus when I needed to. So to sort of from 10 years there, I went from going in as the sort of admin who couldn't type because I'd had a typist when I worked in the bank. I didn't quite tell them that. to leading training programs and, you know, being finance administrator and being manager for some of the projects. I then went on to work with long-term unemployed. I managed a community centre for a couple of years, which is fascinating. And I think my biggest learning out of that was that you can't please all of the people all of the time, no matter how hard you try. Because we had one centre which had so many different groups, from, you know, a youth group to an older people's group to a special needs group to a dance classes in the evening. And whatever you did in that same space for one group could quite often upset the other groups. So it was a real balancing act, and I think I learned a lot there around, you know, there is a balance to be had in terms of trying to keep most of the people happy most of the time, and you're doing a pretty good job.
Yeah.
You'll never please them all.
Yeah.
So that was a good learning experience. I went from there to doing some work nationally, both with a housing trust. And with a learning organisation, so I managed adult guidance networks across the country, and I helped assess projects for funding and reports to board. So that was an interesting sort of move to working more nationally, and quite fascinating. I suppose along that way, I'd had my daughter. I'd split up with my husband, so there was lots of sort of juggles and home life that I think you'd alluded to along the way. I think my daughter was born in my final year of my my MBA. So it was an interesting challenge. And the other interesting bit about that was it did tend to all be businessmen in suits that were doing it. So I had been coming along to exams, you know, as the pregnant mum, which is, you know, quite a different space to be in. But from working nationally in some of these other juggles, I decided at some point that I would quite like to be my own boss and try setting up my own business. So I set up a consultancy company. And I did everything from, I was an assessor with the BBC Children in Need, which was a job I loved, assessing projects sort of on the ground. And one of the lessons I learned from that was that sometimes the people that are doing the best work on the ground aren't necessarily the ones that can write slick applications. And trying to actually see through that into, you know, those that wrote the very slick applications weren't the ones that were obviously always putting the same focus at the front line. Yeah. So trying to get that nuance and get that understanding quite often from a piece of paper and a few phone calls was, you know, a really interesting way of trying to get a depth of trusting understanding with people to be able to help make those decisions. I also ended up, I did everything from ESF funding applications in dark rooms with deadlines to going in and doing team building and strategic planning with groups and teams and, you know, a bit of coaching. So it was a fascinating way to work with the sector. I think I went into it thinking I'd have a better work-life balance and might be able to take a summer off occasionally. But it didn't quite work that way because, you know, when you're the sole breadwinner and you don't want to turn work down, you ended up sometimes probably taking on a bit too much. And also finding that it's the people that know you that often or know your work who will ask you to do work in that situation. And, you know, if it's a 10-day piece of work that actually takes you 20, you know they don't have a lot of money, you know you want to help. So, you know, I think that it is a challenge to be a consultant in a sector that you know the sector well and want to help and support. So as part of that, the Acosta job popped up. So I'm getting to the end of that journey. And it popped up as there was no staff. It was 3 days a week. It was a new organisation. But it sounded fascinating in terms of, you know, bringing leaders together. And what I've always enjoyed is bringing people together and seeing the spark that grows from that and the whole peer support element. So I went into, I think there was about 30 or 40 members. It was a relatively blank sheet, couple of events a year. And it had got together by a group of chief execs who had felt it was quite a lonely place to be. And that if you're not sure about your leadership role, there aren't many places to go. You maybe don't want to share that vulnerability with your funders, with your staff, with your board. You have to be seen as a strong, confident leader. So the fact that they could have a group with a sort of a shoulder to lean on, if you like, and could get that peer support, share good practice, and also start to think about their own leadership development, that was a really good space to be. It was a fascinating organisation, and to some extent it's become my baby over the years, because this December that will be 17 years time, and there's now 10 of us as a core staff. We've got over 600 members, and you know, I think we're relatively well respected and seen as one of the key players in the sector. But I mean, what I'm most proud of from that, I suppose, is the fact that that peer support, good practice sharing and leadership development from the very, very start still underpins everything we do. And it's, for me, it's all about making the connections and bringing people together. And so it's been a fascinating journey that I have, you know, really enjoyed. There's obviously been ups and downs, but
What are the key highlights that stand out for you? Because you're not working for 3 days a week anymore.
No, that went long ago. I suppose the key highlights is both seeing the organisation and the people within that develop, but also seeing, you know, we talk about it being a Cosmo family, and it's about building that ethos of support. You know, there was an example just today that, you know, obviously, and I think we'll go on to speak about the current situation, but some of our members are in a really difficult time and, you know, having to go through difficult situations with redundancies and projects closing. And somebody dropped a message saying, you know, somebody's in a difficult place just now. And two or three of us sort of picked that up and said, you know, we'll drop them a wee message. And it's that sort of collective hug that you can give to people in a difficult space. So So that's definitely a highlight, that we've got to that place, that we can do that. But I think seeing the organisation grow and adapt and develop, because, you know, although the underpinning ethos hasn't changed, the organisation has grown and developed in all different ways, depending on, you know, what our members need from us. You know, we now also have a chairs network. We have a whole load of services that we offer our members. We've recently started developing a whole sort of intelligence strand of work. We gathered lots of case studies from our members about, you know, how COVID had impacted them and their organisations. And, you know, that those were used across the board by policymakers and government and other sector leaders, feeling that, you know, it wasn't just them. So the fact that we've been able to adapt has been really good. And also seeing some of the team that, you know, have come in relatively new to our role and grown and developed and gone on to do, you know, great things in the sector has been really good too.
I think it's interesting, as you're talking, there's that sense of, you know, throughout your earlier career, being that outsider, or even as you were studying your MBA, being that outsider, do you think that shaped your ethos with just creating that family environment?
To some extent, although I don't know about the feeling an outsider piece, because the bit that's always fascinated me is bringing people together across different sectors and across different worlds and learning from that. You know, I was previously involved with the RSA. I was their chair for a little while. I was on the Scotland Committee of the IOD, and looking at sort of government, business, academia, and quite often they sit in silos. And what I often see is the learning that can come between them. And one of the things that I developed from an exchange I did with a European colleague through the European network I'm involved in is a leadership exchange programme. So we match leaders across different sectors to sort of walk alongside each other and walk in each other's shoes. And because I think you get as much from exploring another environment and another way of working as you do seeing your own world through someone else's eyes.
That
gives you a whole new insight. So I think rather than sitting on the outside, what I'm really interested in is stepping between the worlds and going back and forward and making the connections.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. And it's such a fascinating programme, that one. And one that you obviously had experience of yourself as well. How did you find that?
Yeah, no, it's been fabulous. I've had a few different ones. My first one was with a leader from the third sector in Serbia, which, you know, the sector was much less developed at that stage, and she was quite fascinated by, she worked in children's services world and couldn't understand why leaders would come together to support each other because they saw each other as competitors for the same funding.
Interesting.
So for her, coming into this world was quite fascinating, but for me, going to see how things worked with a sector at a much earlier stage was fascinating. But then the relationship and the understanding you can get, you know, from building that trust in the relationship, it was fascinating. So I came back and we're bemoaning the fact that secondees between the sector and government weren't as often these days. And when you get someone that's worked in your sector, they understand so much more quickly. They understand the language, the nuances, the context, the environment. So you can build a relationship much more quickly than someone who doesn't know your sector at all. So we did a pilot with government and third sector, senior civil servants and sector leaders doing exchanges, and that's now developed across all of public services. But I've also done exchanges with a colleague in RBS, which again was fascinating for me actually to go in and see how a big business like that ran, and for them to come into the sector and see the sort of professionalism and the complexity. Whereas I think there's often a lot of myths that we can bust between those two. And also me seeing how, you know, how that the values and ethos within any sector are often not that different because we're all people and we're all human. I'm currently doing an exchange through the Scottish Leaders Forum with a colleague who is a doctor, but is currently leading on the leadership programme within the NHS at the moment, within leaders within the health service. So, you know, that's been, as you can imagine, in current times, that's absolutely fascinating. And also looking at how he has moved from the medical world into government and almost straddles those two. So I'm almost getting a double whammy. And I think because the sector's providing a lot of the healthcare just now as well, for him to be able to get a wider understanding of how that works and make connections and conduits within the sector has been really useful too.
I think that's just so fascinating, having that, as you say, what are usually very siloed sectors coming together and creating that understanding. I think it can only be beneficial content for everybody, really.
Definitely.
And we talked a little bit about, you know, you've seen the challenges as the sector, probably more than most, is responding to COVID-19 and just seeing what that's doing for your members in particular. What have you found to be the biggest concerns for the leaders as you're supporting them through this difficult time?
Well, it's been interesting seeing how they've changed. You know, we've been mapping. We've had more than 1,000 people on calls now in all different ways that we've been providing support. And it started off with, you know, confusion, worries about the staff, worries about the technical side of moving online, worries about funding going forward. I wrote a blog then about leadership and being human. Because I think we were all so busy looking after our staff, our beneficiaries and our organisations, that I could see a lot of the leaders were, you know, having their own challenges and almost having to put them to one side. Which is a real sort of pressure and strain on well-being. So that has sort of moved, I think, to some extent. You know, it's all technical things like the furlough thing at the start, and how do we understand all the different schemes, and everything's working at pace and it's all an emergency response. It's very much moved now towards the last couple of calls. There is a real fatigue setting in because people have been having to work at such pace and to be in that emergency response mode. One of the ways we've talked about it is we're redesigning the plane while flying it. So you're having to remodel what you do while you keep all the balls in the air. And we have members at both ends of the spectrum. Some have had to very quickly scale up the work that they're doing because it's part of the emergency response, whereas some, because their sources of funding have overnight dried up because they can't open their buildings or they can't provide their services, they're having to make staff redundant, they're having to make some very hard decisions, and they're having to wind down. So, you know, pushes and challenges at both sides. And it's only in the more recent calls, and equally with some of the chairs, that the chief exec's well-being has started to be something that is addressed, because it wasn't there at all. And I suppose now the chat is around the recovery period. We're now calling it the next normal rather than the new normal, because I think there will be quite a few next normals. And whether there'll ever be a sort of normal, if you like, is, you know, another story. So not being able to see an end point, I think, is quite hard for people when they've been giving it their all for so long. But we still find that people are getting a huge benefit from hearing each other's stories and realizing that it's not only them that's feeling like that. Trying to find ways that people can feel supported, and some of that is practical help, but some of it is emotional, and some of it is having a supportive network around you, so that if you do need a shoulder to cry on, nowhere to go, or if you do need to find someone else that has been through a similar situation, you know, we can potentially help with that as well.
Yeah, that connection, so that people don't feel alone. I feel like in the last few weeks, I've seen an awful lot of people's out of office replies saying, I just need a break. I'm going to be offline for a little bit. I will be back.
Yeah.
I've not disappeared, that reassurance. But I think you're right. There is a feeling of exhaustion now really setting in, where normally people would have taken their summer holidays, and that's changed too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's also beginning to be a bit more of an understanding of the way that we're currently working. and the different, I know there's been a few things written about the different neurological pathways that, you know, working from this way and the way that you interact, if you were a room full of people, and the way you read the body language, our brains are having to adapt to working in a whole new way. And I think the way you gain energy and the way you reflect are both different. You know, normally I'd be running about the country or running between meetings in the city, and you have that reflection time and you're stepping from one thing to another, and you'll meet people for, you'll have a coffee first and a chat about the weather, and you know, you'll make plans at the end of it. Whereas now we're back to back meetings, you barely have a chance to say hello when you're in the business because you have an hour and you stop one and you go straight into another. So, and I think the way, I know certainly I get a lot of energy from interacting with people, but sometimes I find this way of working a bit more draining. I'm wondering why I'm exhausted at the end of the day, because I've just been sitting speaking to people. I think it's quite interesting to think through what, you know, in terms of the way your brain is working and the way that we have spent our whole lives interacting, that this is different, and it does take a different sort of energy.
It's a really interesting point. If you say just that downtime of going from one meeting, downloading in your brain as you're literally walking from one meeting to another and getting ready, psyching yourself up for the next meeting. That's a really good point, actually, just thinking about how those differences are. What surprised you? I mean, other than the general surprise that it took us all by surprise what's happened in the last 6 months, but what has surprised you and what you've seen in the sector in the last 6 months?
I suppose I've been surprised by, you know, by the supportive family that we do have around us, in the way that sector leaders have come together very much and have very much valued that. I think there has been more collaborative working. I think people have been getting together. I think in terms of the timing of how much, you know, there's a lot of people said, well, we plan to put in a digital program over the next, and we thought it would take us a year, and we did it in a week.
Amazing.
So people have just pulled out the stops when they've had to, basically, and have had to, you know, adapt and change just continuously. The minute you think, okay, I've got that sussed, I can do that now, something else changes. So I think there's been a flexibility that many of us didn't really think we had in us, or a versatility that, you know, this has just made it happen. This is saying, I had my first, there's four of us chief execs walk week before last.
I love these.
Yeah, we have an active leaders program, which has sort of had to be suspended a little bit, where we would walk or cycle, and the whole argument being you don't have to sit around a table to be able to network, you can do it and so be active. Good. Around the whole thing about well-being. We even had a kayaking session once. And there is something, I suppose I've taken it from, you know, I'm a bit of a hill walker, and from when you're in the hills, you talk about so many things, and you build such a strong relationship with people. And there's also some studies about, you know, when you're walking together and not face-to-face, it's much less confrontational. So it's much easier to be open about things and, you know, just have a conversation in a different way. So we had our first leadership walk, and it was just really useful to actually get back with people in a different way. And I suppose in some ways that's sort of surprised me that I've missed that so much. But it's also surprised me that to some extent we hadn't done it sooner. And I know we're working within the guidelines, and there was only four of us, and we've also had a senior management team meeting in a park now. But there is something about you. I'm slightly worried that we get into a comfort zone of this way of working.
Interesting, yeah.
Because, you know, I now have this thought of, oh, actually, it's going to take me 40 minutes to get there. Then I'll have the meeting that'll take me 40 minutes to get back, and I won't be able to fit in quite as much. And, you know, are we putting ourselves at risk? Are we putting anybody else at risk? Are we meeting all the requirements that are around us just now? So I think I'm a little bit worried we might get into this comfort bubble of this way of working, which you know has to be at the moment. And I think there's a beauty of it that we will hang on to. I know certainly most of my team want to go back to a blended way of working.
Yes.
There's no great desire to all be back in the office. So it's just going to change our way of thinking and our way of working.
Yeah.
Hugely.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a study recently and exactly the same thing came up, that people want to have that blended working and what that then means. So is that then you have very intensive meetings whilst you're in the office all together, and then you have your downtime, and just structuring that again, as you say, neurologically, that takes adjustment, doesn't it? Thinking about switching almost between the two.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been fascinating just hearing all the different ways our members are planning to do a phased return. You know, from having different teams that have set days that they can go in, or having a sort of office monitor that you have to register through, or so there's a whole load of different ways sort of developing about, you know, how people might work in the future.
Yeah,
never mind things like your AGMs and your conference and all the other things that we do.
And the first online conference for you this year as well. It's going to take a bit of getting used to it.
It is, yeah. Well, we had a mentoring conference earlier this week, which went really well. So we've had a bit of a practice, which is great. And I've been joining a few other ones. And I think that gives you confidence and lets you see what works and what doesn't. But
yeah,
I mean, we had a real debate at the start about whether or not to postpone having a conference, because a lot of our members will say, if I don't get to any other events in a year, the one time I want to come along is to the conference. It's the one I won't miss because it's my chance to see all the people I haven't seen all year because I've been so busy.
Yeah.
So that feel good buzz is quite hard to replicate.
Yeah, it is.
We felt if we pushed it into next year, there's no guarantee that we wouldn't be sitting three seats apart with a mask, and maybe that buzz wouldn't still not be there.
So
I think people are getting so used to being able to connect on screen now, and to, you know, to do it that way, that we might still have a celebration. Now, COSFO was 20 this year, so we plan to have a celebration. So although I've not been with it the full 20 years since they got sort of registered as a charity, so I think we're going to celebrate being 21 next year instead.
Lovely. That's a good one. Yeah, 21 can be just as impactful as the round 20. And we've talked about authentic leadership before and how authentic leaders are shaped by their own experiences. And you've always been incredibly honest about your own challenges as well. So I was wondering, Pat, in terms of, for you, what values are important to you personally, and how do you translate that into your professional life?
I think you're right. The values that are just so important, and I shy a wee bit away from the sort of authentic leadership, not from the what it is, but you know, it's almost seen as another leadership style, which is not. It's about who you are and how you bring yourself to your role. And I suppose maybe, you know, to give an example, my second husband passed away a few years ago, and a few months afterwards, because I know a lot of my members, I'd been writing a blog because we were on our travels when it happened. So they had been through the journey with me to some extent. And I stood up at a conference and, you know, talked about how that journey had had cancer, and how being a leader when you have all that, those other sort of things going on in your life that are very much important, but also you have a really strong feel for your organization and you want to support that too, and how that sort of can be quite a pull for you in terms of of where your priorities lie. Obviously they very much lay with my husband at that point, but what I found very fascinating within, to some extent, that was the best feedback we ever got from the conference. And I think it was because within minutes of me being open and sharing some of my challenges, it made everybody else in the room able to share theirs. So I think the conversations that day were much deeper and more honest than they would have been otherwise, when we all have a professional front on things. And I think that taught me that there is something around vulnerability in leadership. And vulnerability is maybe the wrong word. That actually opens up a whole different way of interacting and builds trust much more quickly than it would if you have a very professional face on things. And to some extent, I know the flip side of that. I remember going into an organisation in the very early days as a leader and thinking I was being very open and collaborative and saying, you know, I'm very new to this. You guys have been doing it for a long time. You're the experts. I want us all to work together on this. And it was a much earlier stage of my leadership journey. And I think at that point, it was seen as a sign of weakness. And it took me a long, long time after going in with that feeling. You know, the feeling then with the team was, she doesn't really know what she's doing and she needs us to tell her and maybe we should have had that job. And it took me a long time to build the trust and understanding that I was capable of doing it. So I think there is something about being open, honest and authentic at the right point, at the right time.
Yes.
Because you don't want it to undermine people's trust in you.
Yeah.
So that it maybe is something around how you would do that with peers and how you would do that with your staff team. And I think there's maybe nuances about, you know, how that authenticness can come over that I've learned that we have to take into account. But I think in a peer group, it is very important. And I've found that in other situations when people are really honest about, you know, a work situation and how difficult it is. You immediately get people saying, oh God, I thought it was just me that was worried about that. You know, let's have a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can see that completely. And in terms of, you know, you talked about the professional, the personal, you know, intensity, a lot going on. What support to you is important for you to get both inside and outside of work?
I think for me, there's something about where your escape and where your safe space is and where your outlet is. For me, that's worked in lots of different ways. I mean, one way is to have supportive people around you that, you know, you can be very open with. I've got a bit of a strange life that I have an escape. My late husband had a place on the Isle of Skye. So I have almost extremes of an incredibly busy time when I'm in my day job, but I have an escape that I can go and be on my own if I need to be, and that's really important to me. I know some of our members, it's, you know, it's digging the garden, and that's where they do their best thinking. I got very much into running when my husband was in hospital, and that was from, you know, just to go out and run was my sort of place where I could, so almost the alternative to screaming is just to go run and, you know, let that energy out in a different way.
So
I think everybody has their own, you know. I know for some people it's baking, it, you know, it might be sailing, but I think there is something about finding and acknowledging what are the spaces for you that give you the energy back when you need it. You know, time with my kids, even though they're now grown up, is just equally something that takes me away from the day job. They have no idea what I do, and, you know, it's something to do with charities, neither does my mother. So yeah, it's still, I suppose, that stepping between worlds. I still love to travel as well. Obviously that's not happening quite as much these days, but I love to travel and just immerse myself in other worlds as well.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea of acknowledging that, because I think, you know, we do have these outlets, but we maybe don't acknowledge them, and therefore that means you don't acknowledge the importance of them and that you need that balance in your life. I really like that, actually. And lastly, what impact do you feel you've had in the sector, Pat, and what would you want your legacy to be?
Interesting one. I mean, I would hope I've developed a support network for third sector leaders, obviously, and raised the profile of the need for that.
Yeah.
The other bit, I sometimes feel I'm a bit of a sort of fly in the ointment sometimes, because I think there's something about joining the dots. And in the early days, I felt like I was always going on to these different networks, or, you know, part of the Scottish Leaders Forum with government and public service leaders. And I felt like in the early days, I was always the one saying, what about the third sector? You know, we're an equally important part of the economy, of, you know, inclusive growth, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that message has got through a lot more now, and we're around the table more. But I think for me, it's still they've been able to join the dots between the different sectors. People are very well connected in their own field of work. But there isn't that many platforms where they can come together across different subsectors or different specialisms. And quite often that's when you see the biggest benefit of collaborations, is where it's from different specialisms or different sectors or different networks. And I think because I've been very privileged to have a bit of an overview from all the different things that I'm involved in, I get a lot of energy from being able to say, you should speak to them over there. So I would hope I've made some connections and joined some dots along the way.
I think that's really interesting. It's been fantastic speaking to you, Pat. Thanks so much.
Okay, I hope that's been helpful, and great to speak to you too, Anna.
Thanks
very much.